Welcome back, everybody, to Soft Revolution, the podcast. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And this week on the pod, we have the novelist, essayist, cultural commentator, Stephen Marsh. He's going to come in and speak to us about a number of things, including the notion of cultural appropriation, what that means, and what it how deep it sits inside of all of us. He's a great writer. I've been reading his stuff over the last week, Ali. I don't know if you've gotten a chance to, but...
Yes, I have.
Very lucid, doesn't mind saying things that might upset and irritate people. Terrific. So we're really looking forward to speaking to Stephen, and we're grateful he's going to be here. He's written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Esquire, The Walrus. And actually he's doing a podcast right now that I'm really enjoying, which is on Audible, if you're an Audible subscriber, which is called How Not to Fuck Up Your Marriage Too Bad. I have not fucked my marriage up, just in case you're wondering, despite whatever you might hear from my wife from time to time. No, but it's a really cool documentary series, very honest and very kind of clear about some really basic things about being in love with someone for a long, long time. And I'm really enjoying it. So if you get a chance, check his podcast out too, which is on Audible, called How Not to Fuck Up Your Marriage Too Bad. So later on, we'll be talking to Stephen. And we're
Can I say something quick?
Please.
Listen, you're going to listen to the interview with Stephen. You're going to read his work. And here's what I'm going to say. We are all down for discussion here. You know, if there is something that you want to talk about that either Torkel brings up or I bring up or Stephen brings up, like, please, like, get in touch. Find us at SoftRevCast at Twitter. We like to talk. Join our Patreon. You could talk to us. But I just want to make a general kind of note here. And I want everyone to sit down before I say this. It's okay to disagree, guys. It's okay to not agree with everything that is said. Surprise, surprise, I don't fully agree with everything that comes out of Torque's mouth.
How dare you?
I got to edit.
That was Soft Revolution for another week. Thank you for joining us. I will be back alone next week.
But yes, we have to build a proper community. You know, we have to be able to like talk to each other. You know, I was listening to Sam Harris's podcast the other day, and Sam Harris, very smart guy. And he was going on about the Capitol insurrection. And, you know, for 20, 30 minutes, I'm like, man, this is some brilliant shit this guy's saying. Boom, boom, boom. And then finally, he was saying some stuff. I was like, that's dumb. But I didn't just all of a sudden get all freaked out about it. I continued listening. I found my own ideas. My ideas got solidified. Some of my ideas got put to doubt. And yeah, you know, this is what this podcast is about.
I think that's an important thing to say. We've gotten some letters about having Stephen on the show. He is an opinionated person, and he has made no secrets of his thoughts, which I admire, even in people I disagree with. And I would say this, too, that I think one of the reasons we started this show was, as you say, Ali, you and I are not always in agreement about things, but we really love each other, and we respect each other, and we come from the same place of wanting the world to be a kinder, more compassionate, more open, and most of all, more creative place. And I think Stephen also comes from that place. And I just think that the left really have to start to reckon with the extent to which we have prioritized orthodoxy ahead of everything.
It's like you religious.
Know, the right wing don't have this problem. As long as you're racist and selfish, you can be in the club. You know, you can have all kinds of different opinions about marijuana or whether we should invade Iraq, whatever you want. But as long as you're racist and selfish, you too can be a conservative. And I think that those of us who are not racist and selfish, i.e. most of the human race, i.e. progressives, i.e. the normal human beings in society, because conservatism now certainly has to be classified as some form of deviant behavior at this point. We have to stop.
Ali Moman disagrees, but go on, Torque.
We have to stop this constant seeking of points of conflict amongst those of us who are in the progressive movement. There's going to be disagreements about ideas. There always has been, and there always will be. And I'm just really hoping that as this podcast grows, we can have people on here whose ideas we may disagree with, whose ideas you may disagree with, without it turning into a sort of weekly festival of doom about how terrible it is that we had someone on who you disagree with, and you can't believe that we did that. How could we do that? You know, I don't know what to tell you. If you only want to hear that which you believe, then curate your life. But it's kind of not up to us. So anyway, Stephen Marsh is coming up later, and we're going to have a great chat. And we're going to go over some of the news of the week. But first, as we mentioned, Ali, we've started this partnership with Crow's Theater. We are now official partners. We are now officially in residence at Crow's Theater, even though, of course, we're not in residence. That's one of those terms that's like, I'm in residence
these
in my bedroom.
Means nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. But
we're in sweatpants at Crow's Theater.
You dressed up, man. I'm in my pajamas. Moya and I, my wife now, we go from like, we're like 5 to 7 cozies, and then we have 7 to 10 PM cozies that are even cozier than the cozies we had when we were just trying to get through the day. It's just unbelievable. So we've started this partnership with Crow's, and they're gonna do all kinds of stuff with us and for us. They're gonna help support and promote the podcast. And so part of that is letting you all know about their upcoming projects. Longtime listeners might remember that in the before times when we could all gather stars, my band collaborated with Crow's, especially with Chris Abraham, my dear friend and collaborator, on this play called Together. And it was an amazing experience. We hope we can do it in other cities when life comes back.
And what's awesome is, you know, Crow's, they're still making it. They're still making art.
They are.
They're still doing it. They've curated a digital salon series called Dinner and the Show. And there's actually one coming up in February.
Yes, I've seen one of these, and it's fantastic because Crow's has this great French restaurant in its lobby called Gare de l'Est. And the idea is this: they put on a show which you get to stream from the comfort of wherever you are. And if you're in Toronto, Gare de l'Est will deliver you this beautiful gourmet meal for two, created specifically to go along with the show you're watching. So,
and guess what? There's wine, baby. There's wine.
It comes with as many bottles of wine as you want. Is that right? That's what I'm reading.
Hold on. No, it says here up to 2 bottles of wine.
Well,
up to 2.
I think that's a little stingy, but as many, I don't know. I mean, listen, as many bottles of wine as you want, as long as it's 1 or 2. Does that seem like a reasonable, how many fucking bottles of wine? You fucking drunks, just watch
yes,
the
think
show.
About it. Actually, I understand why there's only 2 bottles of wine, because there's, like, let's say 2 people in the house, you're drinking a bottle each, they want you to like
that's
be awake.
That's plenty. That's
they
plenty.
Don't want you falling off on your Zoom, you know? So anyways, the February edition is Dinner and a Show, Entrances and Exits. The performance is an award-winning improv show that is being live-streamed every night directly from their theater, Streetcar
Wow,
Process.
So they're doing it live. What a concept.
Damn right.
Unbelievable. I really, really hope that can continue. And the improvisers are Second City alumni. They've got special guests coming in. I've heard rumor that Colin Mochrie, who's one of the great improv performers in the world, I would say, is going
I'd
to be
so.
Joining one of these events. So you should really check it out. Go to the Crow's Theater website or the Howlin' Company for entrances and exits. It's live streamed from the February 11th all the way to Valentine's Day. So it's a perfect Valentine's Day celebration for you and your loved one if you're at home, as we all are. And it comes with wine, it comes with dinner, it comes with a gourmet meal kit and tickets. And it can be reserved for as little as $160, which, you know, is...
No, that's for the Valentine's experience, bro.
Oh, that's just the Valentine's Day.
Yeah, everyone's wondering what the F to do for Valentine's Day. This is what you do. You order the full dinner and show experience on Valentine's Day. You get wine, you get dinner for two, you get the gourmet meal kits, you get tickets. And it's for $160, $80 a person. And that is going to help out the restaurant. It's going to help out the artists. It's the way to do it. You're not going to do anything better. What are you going to watch? Queen's Gambit again? Forget it.
Can I talk about Queen's Gambit for a second? Can I lose us some viewers? Why?
I love that show.
That's
I love
not
it.
Good. That's not a good show. That's not a good show. It's not good. Why is everyone talking such an odd way to each other on that program? Why can't anyone have a bit of a smile occasionally?
Because it's chess, bro.
Cheer up,
it's
everyone.
Chess.
It's just chess. I found the whole thing a little suffocating. I mean, I liked the idea. I love Bill Camp and Anya Taylor-Joy is obviously extraordinary to watch on screen. She's like got a face like Audrey Hepburn. It's that extraordinary to watch on screen.
Yeah.
And she's a terrific actor, but I don't know. I found the whole thing a bit dead in the water, but that's just me. I don't know. Anyway, watch Queen's Gambit after you do dinner and a show at our partners, Crow's Theater. Go check it out.
CrowsTheater.com. CrowsTheater.com.
Okay, let's get to how to take care of artists, namely buying tickets for things like dinner and a show. But also, I wanted to start the week by talking about this big piece in the good old New York Times. You know, sometimes you love them, sometimes you hate them. And it's called "The Arts Are in Crisis. Here's How Biden Can Help." It's by Jason Farrago. And Ali, it essentially says what we've been saying for the last 9 months without the benefit of the New York Times as a platform. He argues for a New Deal, which I think is just like, I hate this term, but it really is a no-brainer. It seems so obvious that that's what should be happening with artists. He argues for instituting some form of permanent income or guaranteed income for artists, which I also think has become pretty much a widely held opinion, not just for artists, but for all gig economy workers. And he also talks about the real crux of what we've been chatting about since the very beginning of this podcast, which is the idea of bringing artists into the room when you're doing infrastructure projects, when you're building public policy, embedding unemployed artists in those rooms, putting artists into local government, into state government, into federal government, is a way not just of getting artists back to work, but of rebuilding a society in which culture has a healthy, sustainable, interactive place that people can actually benefit from. So it's, I thought, a really good article. I really appreciated that the Times gave this much space to it. And Mario Cuomo, the governor of New York, also came out. I don't know if you want to cover that, Ali.
Andrew Cuomo. He came out and he spoke about, yeah, he has a plan that he wants to bring arts and culture back to life. And he's imagining a bunch of pop-up concerts and shows all across the city with celebrities and non-celebrities. And he's going to give out like 1,000 or so kind of grants. And he says something interesting. He goes, you know, cities are by definition centers of energy, entertainment, theater, and cuisine. Without that activity and attraction, cities lose much of their appeal. And that's really true. Like,
yeah,
you know, we have to think of this. I want to ask Stephen this too, because he's such a, you know, he's a Toronto guy, and obviously his wife is the editor in chief of Toronto Life. And you want to ask, like, what is the future of cities? Like, this is imperative, because a city is all of this culture and life and art, and without it, I have to say though, this article is lovely, and I'm glad it's in the art section of the New York Times. But who's going to read it and who's going to care? And that is a really, really, really difficult problem. The history of the WPA is that it kind of was like Roosevelt who gave a shit. He really actually viewed it as something that is truly important for society. And as much as I want to speak about, you know, we need to get artists in the room in respect to infrastructure projects, a conversation we could have later on one day is that we actually need to get artists in politics. Like, we have to ultimately start to be in the room where it happens, you know, the cliche Hamilton line. We have to honestly thrust ourselves peacefully, not some, you know, insurrection style, but we got to be in the room. We got to get in the room.
And we have to put people there, because I do think, you know, one of the depressing but inevitable things about this New York Times article is if you read the comments, there are dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of people saying, oh, who gives a shit about art? Nobody cares. There's more important things. I really do believe that there needs to be some serious effort made about arguing the reason for our existence. Because I think that art and culture have drifted so far away from most people's daily lives. Now that there is not music programs and art programs in school, now that there are not local repertory theaters and local bars and local clubs that play music, all this stuff before the pandemic was dying out. Art, the notion of art being a part of your daily life other than a Netflix show, has been drifting away from the vast majority of people in society for many, many years. And I think the reason that we are having such a hard time getting any kind of traction for making an argument for saving the arts right now is because it doesn't have this connection in people's lives that going out to a restaurant, for example, does, or going to the movies does. So we have to acknowledge that reality. We have allowed the performing arts and visual arts to become an elitist activity, or at least to be perceived that way. And that's not a new idea. I know people know that, and I know people have been making a good faith effort to try and find different audiences and go out to people and make them feel less threatened when they walk into cultural institutions, but it hasn't worked. And
that's a challenge of advocacy, though, Torque. That's a challenge of advocacy in a situation like that, because people go like, I don't get it, or they understand it kind of loosely, but not fully. And this kind of very much applies to the issues that I have with the lockdowns that I'm seeing, not just in Canada and Ontario, but where they don't work, is that it's very difficult sometimes to argue certain things that you might know in abstract to be true. Like, we know that if art touches every aspect of society, society is a better society. But sometimes you just have to, like, show it. You know, when they did that huge crazy lockdown in Melbourne, it's not like everyone was like, oh, thank you so much, this is so exciting. It was very difficult, but there was a return on the investment. It was visible. The rewards were reaped. And I kind of think that's why when I speak about, listen, like, if you really give a shit, you know, it's time to go beyond advocacy. It's time to be in positions of power. And that could be many things, from running for politics, running for office. It could also be like, you know what? Like, let me get on a board of this thing and that thing, because you don't understand. Like, these boards are so fucking important. And I got to tell you, not everyone on the board is like the cream of the crop. They just, they're just there. And you're like, who are you? Why are you on this board? And it's like, I'm on this board. Why? What have you done? What do you know?
They're,
you
know, supposed,
and that's
to be there.
The policies we get.
This is the this is a massive issue, and I think we should devote a whole episode to this. When my father was in line to run the Stratford Festival, which was in the 1980s, he was brought in to be interviewed by the board of directors, who were made up of bankers, businessmen, people who had no experience whatsoever in the theater, were given the job of electing, deciding who was going to be the next person to run the Stratford Festival artistically. So already, would they let us pick their board of directors? Think again. There is no fucking way. So why do we allow these people in? Okay, it's money. They have access to money. They have access to funding. So we need them. We've decided we need them. So my dad goes in to be interviewed by this bunch of bankers about whether or not he's qualified to be the artistic director of the Stratford Festival. And they say to him, what is the first thing you would do as artistic director of the Stratford Festival? And my father, being the man he was, said to them, I would fire all of you. So spoiler alert, he didn't get the job. But what other answer could he possibly give in earnest? If you are going to try to rebuild or build any kind of meaningful cultural connection to your audience, and if you're going to try and build a cultural institution that is one of justice and equity and fairness and compassion, how do you begin by endowing 12 bankers with the power to decide what the artistic direction of your theater company is? It is absurd on its face. And we've been living with it and lumping it and rolling our eyes, but accepting it in the cultural community for decades. And I think that as bad as this is, and as bad a shape as we are in now, this is a moment of opportunity to really begin to reassess how big these institutions can be, and where these institutions are going to get their funding, and who is actually in charge of making big decisions at these institutions. Because too often right now, the conversation is focused on artistic staff. It's too often the conversation ends at this director or that, you know, that artistic director or this designer or this person who auditioned me. Yes, all that stuff is important, but there is a whole layer of power structure in cultural institutions above those people, which is made up of dilettantes. which is made up of people who have no idea how to make art. They've never done it themselves. They don't know what it costs. They don't know how much time it takes. They don't know what kind of environment you need to make it properly. They don't know anything about it. It's not their fault. You know, they like the arts. They wanted to be on a board of directors. Somebody asked them to be on the board of directors. They said yes. You know, you can't fault people for wanting to go and raise money for a theater. But you can say to them, you are not capable, having raised that money, of telling me how to spend it. And I think that until we address that more fundamental issue, until we stop going cap in hand to the wealthy of our society and saying, what would you like to see? How would you like our lobby to be? What would you like our program to be like? What should we not say? What should we say? Until we stop having that conversation, how can we really have an artistic community that feels free or is like able to withstand this kind of catastrophe? Because we're not in power. We don't have leverage of power. So how do we get our theaters back? How do we get our rock concert halls back? We don't own them. We don't own the means of production. So here we are as the workers waiting for somebody to decide that we're a priority. And in Ontario, fucking Doug Ford, the failed hash dealer from Etobicoke, has bumbled his way through this disaster on every front. He was responsible for people dying. He is responsible for the terrible economy. He is a towering moron. And now he has made a decision, apparently, which says you can shoot TV and film, but you can't have five people live streaming something in a theater. Now, rumor has it that there has been outcry about this. This is in Ontario, folks. For those of you not listening in Ontario, there's been a new lockdown and there are new rules. You can still go to Costco, by the way, with 900 of your closest friends, but you cannot watch a live stream. I mean, but this comes from the fact that there's nobody in the Conservative government who gives a shit about art. They're not going to watch a live stream. They don't go to the theater. They don't like the theater. They don't like art. They think it's for losers. So, like, you're right, Ali. All this to say, until we get more Charlie Angus's and more Andrew Cash's and more Ali Momans, I'm hoping, into politics, we can't make this argument. We need people who are actually passionate and actually have some knowledge about the nuts and bolts of the business to go in and make this argument to the politicians. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, Gal Gadot singing Imagine and everyone rolling their eyes at us and saying, oh, artists, they always want attention. It's always about them. They think they're so special. No, we don't. We think we deserve to make a living and do what we do. And we want to be able to entertain and enliven and you know, cheer people up with the work we make. That's what we like to do. There's nothing inherently namby-pamby or highbrow or highfalutin about that. It's just a simple desire to tell stories and to entertain people. People have done it for hundreds of thousands of years. We have a right to make a living. And it's nice to see at least that in New York City, where there's an economic imperative to get art back up on its feet, the politicians are starting to listen. But in places like Canada, where we've relied on a public funding model for so long, where art has been looked upon as charity for so long, and we've had so many not-for-profit institutions, how do you make the argument to people when we've already spent so much money on CERB and that we need more money for the arts? This is the problem with art not being profitable.
But there's a larger problem. There's a larger problem. The larger problem is we used to have like a 10-minute memory, you know, where after 10 minutes we forget and we move on. Now we have like a 20-second memory or a 5-second memory because of TikTok, Instagram. I mean, we're swiping left and right for love. Like, it's crazy. So we're at this situation where until we're like over the cliff and we fall down and it like blows up, we don't really recognize what the F is actually happening in our societies. It's difficult for us to have conversations. So we have to have George Floyd for us to be like, oh shit, wait a second, there's systemic racism. We have to have an insurrection at the Capitol for Republicans to wake up and be like, oh shit, maybe this guy's a fucking fascist.
Yes.
So, and that's what I am really kind of like worried about, that I go, we have this like really deep, insidious kind of death that's happening in culture, but until the buildings are gone, until the artists, until Gal Gadot can't even sing Imagine, people won't wake up and say, wait a second. Wait a second. And that is the issue.
I agree with you. I'm sorry to say I agree with you. I do think it will take cataclysm.
Yeah, it's a large, large issue in total. And that's why this goes to the first thing I mentioned in the pod. It's really important for us to be able to like have big discussions now and to have imaginative thought that, as I always say, is not thinking about like what now, but what's next, you know, like what's happening, what's actually going on in this world, because otherwise we got a problem. But I do want to talk about this ownership of means of production, because you promised me you would explain this to me. Why is Taylor Swift re-recording her music again? I don't know if y'all know, but this has been like a couple year story. But this woman, because of Scooter Braun, who was the manager and is the manager of Bieber and Shawn Mendes, this is the guy who goes on YouTube and he finds the Canadians. I don't know what he's up to, but he's doing a good job. But this guy supposedly owns her music and now she needs to re-record her old albums. Please explain.
This guy owned her music and then he sold her music to someone else. And this happens all the time in the music industry. For example, our album Set Yourself on Fire was initially owned by our record label. But our record label then sold a piece of it to a holding company, to a guy who's actually a real estate agent. So now, after 15 years, we are trying to get that record back because we signed a deal in perpetuity, much like Dave Chappelle did when he gave his Chappelle show to HBO. But we're not Dave Chappelle, so we don't have the pull to just go and ask these people to give us our record back. We have to figure out what it will take for us to go and find this guy who does real estate and for him to give back that piece of our record to Arts and Crafts so that Arts and Crafts can then give back the record to us. And that's what I'm assuming happened with Taylor Swift. Scooter Braun owned her catalog. He sold a portion or all of the catalog to a third party. And that third party now owns those master recordings. And she can't use those master recordings in any way, shape, or form without gaining permission, as if she hadn't written the songs or recorded them. So she actually,
wow.
The way around that, the first record deal Starz ever signed, we had to give away the record we had already recorded in perpetuity and collect zero revenue for the rest of our lives. We've never seen a penny from Night Songs, our first album. That's how we got out of a record deal that gave us an advance of $1,500. Okay, so this is the record industry. We're not talking about sanity or fairness or justice. This is a toilet, right? This is the music industry. Think of a loan sharking operation mixed with an abattoir. That is what the music industry is. So we had to give this guy who owned this record company that he ran out of his parents' basement our first album in perpetuity, and he stipulated that we could never record those songs again. So Taylor Swift is lucky to be able to re-record her catalog, because in many cases, they don't let you do that. You just don't have access to those songs anymore. You can play them live because you wrote them, but you cannot ever re-record them, do them in any other form, remix them, rearrange them. All of that is verboten. So that's basically what she's doing. She's trying to, as closely as she can, recapture every single take of every single piece of music she ever made so that she can re-release it on her own record company and make the profits instead of these scumbags who bought her catalog.
That's
what's happening with Taylor Swift. Oh, it's fucked. And, you know, that's, again,
it's just fucked, I mean, that, like, Taylor Swift, who I know writes her own stuff. I mean, I know it's like Taylor Swift plus Max Martin and this
plus
case, 15 you know,
changes. Other people.
Yeah, 15 Taylor Swift Inc. But that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah, it's a hell of a game, capitalism. And it only has one winner, and it's the asshole. So, yeah, I think that, again, at least she has a for-profit business, right? At least she has intellectual property that is making her money and she's found her audience. So she can go re-record those songs and she can get back to selling those songs to the people who like them. When you're talking about art, quote-unquote, i.e. culture that is not mainstream, when you're talking about the vast middle class of art and how we get back, we're not getting back without help. We're not getting back until the public decides that we're important again. And I think you're right, Ali. It breaks my heart to say it, but I truly believe that until the ROM closes down, until the Stratford Festival no longer exists, until people can't realize, they look at the paper and they realize there's only five venues left in Toronto to go see a rock show, I don't think they'll care. And yeah. I don't think much will happen. And so that is why, you know, we've so often been promoting the notion of entrepreneurism on this podcast and trying to get everybody out there who is an artist to try as much as they can to be self-sufficient, to start to be literate with how to use the internet to sell what you have, to start to be more outgoing and stand more boldly for the work you do and not expect representatives to do that for you. I think those days are in the rear view. I think every artist has to be a hustler now. And we're hoping that we have guests on here who help you with that hustle.
Yeah, and there was something very interesting. You know, Kelly Nestruck, who's the reviewer, the theater critic for the Globe and Mail, Torkel, don't. I know. Anyways, just let me finish. Let me finish. He someone wrote an Intermission magazine.
Stop you. Just
what?
You just walked me into a controversy I didn't even
I know what I'm saying, because I just know that you would be like, hey, I wish Kelly Nestruck would write more about the plight.
I know who Kelly Nestruck is. He's the guy
who makes lists
for the Globe and Mail.
He wrote stars, right?
If he likes something, he gives something 4 stars, and if he doesn't like it, it's 2 stars. I know who that guy is.
I give you 4 stars. Anyway, so yeah. what he was saying, there was an article in Intermission magazine, which is like a little online magazine for people in the Toronto theater community. And someone was talking about like their permanent pivot away from theater. And he was like, you know, I'm very surprised and I'm worried about the permanent pivot of like theater artists going on to other things. And I was about to write him, but I was like, bro, what do you expect? Like the theater in very few places, I would say with the exception of maybe Germany, maybe if you're someone who's just doing Broadway show after Broadway show after Broadway show, like it is a very difficult and impossible life to sustain.
It was never
right?
easy.
Like it was never easy. And right. this kind of surprise, pandemic or not, Hannah Moscovich came in and told him that. That it's just impossible. And this is something really to think about. You know, it's like,
well, if you want to look at the state of things in the cultural community, particularly in the theater, just clock that people in administration at the Stratford Festival still have their jobs. People in administration at the National Arts Center still have their jobs. Kelly Nestruck, who is a theater critic, still has his job. Despite the fact that there's no theater, the only people who don't have their jobs still are the people who make the theater, the actors, designers, technicians, dressers, the people who are actually there doing the thing no longer have their jobs. But everyone who makes their living keeping up the superstructure around culture still has their jobs. And we have to ask ourselves, now, I'm not saying I want those people to lose their jobs. I want them to keep their jobs. I want there to be a theater critic at the Globe and Mail. I want there to be people to administrate what's happening at the National Arts Center. But this is not a sign of health that our institutions are still alive and the people who depend on the institution are still working, but the people who depend on the audience are not. That is not healthy. And it cannot continue. And the institutions and the politicians have an obligation to start trying to figure out how to solve this problem and not just be like, well, we're doing the best we can. At least the lights are on. The lights being on means nothing if there's no art inside. So, big problem.
Let's go to Stephen. But in terms of audience, Fauci was on a, he spoke to a panel and he did say that he does think that theaters can return in September.
I think
basically
he's full,
full
of
capacity,
he's
with
full
some
of shit.
Masking, definitely masking, but with the caveat of the vaccination has to be on schedule, and it is on schedule. Wait, it's not. Okay, so let's talk.
Dr. Fauci, I'm going to say this in a Brooklyn accent. I love you, but you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. All right. Let's get to Stephen, because I think that another thing that we can begin our conversation with Stephen about this is like art has placed itself in this position of being good for you. And I think that part of the argument about why it's hard to make the argument to people right now about support the arts is they're like, it doesn't stop lecturing me about how art is good for the world. I don't need art to put food on the table. I don't need art to put clothes on my body. I need healthcare, education, and a job, right? I get it. But I think that's a self-inflicted wound to some degree, this notion of art being virtuous. And so maybe we'll start off our conversation with Stephen about that, because he touches on that lot of what he writes about. This is Stephen Marsh on Soft Revolution. Listen, thank you so much for doing this. We really, really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I know you probably are getting tons of requests to do these things at this point, so we won't take up tons of your time. But
no problem.
I wanted to start actually with something that was not germane to why we asked you in the first place, just to be annoying. Because I know that you have for several years now, our friend, mutual friend Amy Black mentioned this to me, been writing and thinking about the possibility of civil war in the United States.
Yeah.
So you must be feeling quite pleased with yourself at the moment.
Well,
because
not really.
It seems to be happening. Is this playing out the way you imagined it would?
Yeah. I mean, like, not to toot my own horn or anything. Well, it's not really tooting my own horn. Like, I interviewed, 200 people for this book.
Right.
So these patterns are not, they're not particularly complicated. They're pretty well established. And like historically in terms of the politics of spoils, in terms of the threat multipliers, in terms of like, talking to the far right, like I went to Ohio and Iowa several times to meet with far right people. And you could, like, it wasn't particularly hard to see it coming, to be honest. Like, it's kind of inevitable that when you create the level of hyperpartisanship they have with the inequality that they have, like, it is really a recipe for disaster.
Well, you wrote in 2018 in The Walrus, I read a piece of yours, and
yeah.
You talk about how, like, we misunderstood America. Like, we saw Barack Obama, we see Michelle, and I think we see Beyonce, we see this kind of America that doesn't exist. Like, how do we misunderstand it as Canadians?
Well, I think one of the things that that is really hard to understand is that, what causes friction is not the poor rising up. Like, when we have this 19th century idea of uprising, that it's like the poor, the starving masses turn against the people above. And so that's sort of filtered down to the point where we're like, well, the Rust Belt has been alienated from from the mainstream. And like, I remember I went to Ohio right after I'd come back from Africa, and I was in this town which was filled with militants, and you could get at the 7-Eleven, they had like cheese and chili that came out of the wall that you could put on a hot dog. Right. And I was like, this is not a poor place. Like, it just is. It's just not a poor place. And so what the trend that actually happens is, as lower, the technical term is horizontal inequality. So that means like groups that are unequal, as they rise, violence increases. And, so as people, as African-Americans, as immigrant groups get closer to white levels of power, then the white people tend to get extremely angry. And this replicates itself all over the world. Like, that's part of the reason of what happened in Rwanda. In India, the number one cause of violence, like the number one correlate for violence on the streets, is when Muslim groups get close to Hindu groups. Right. Yeah. So like, you're dealing with trends here that have are extremely profound and are found all over the world, and they're just replicating themselves in America.
Because this is a culture show, I wanted to ask you, I'm just hearing people on the floor of the House of Representatives right now saying, this all happened because Robert De Niro called Donald Trump a dog, and it happened because Kathy Lee Griffin held a head. When you did these interviews and when you went to these places and talked to these people, to what degree did culture play a part in their radicalization? Is it, in fact, some of it actually about the fact that they simply don't like the kind of people we are?
No. Culture, in terms of like Robert De Niro and so on, like, they feel threatened by a multicultural society that is coming to be in certain aspects of the United States. I mean, what this is really about is that America is a 61% white country, and by 2050, it will be a majority, like white people would be a majority minority. Sorry, right. A minority majority in the country. So, right. Like, I don't like the arguments about culture and so on. Like, those, I don't really. You have to understand, in this book, I'm trying to deal with really strong models, like really good models, models that really apply everywhere. Mm. And, you know, those just don't really apply. I mean, I would say that they definitely feel that their country's being taken away from them in lots of ways, in educational systems, in culture, for sure. But, you know, like they... I wouldn't look for a lot of coherence here, right? Like like, you know, I think when you look at things like a policeman being beaten to death on the steps of the Capitol building by a man holding a American, like with an American flagpole, which with the police possibly being complicit in some ways and the people killing the police wearing Blue Lives Matter shirts and badges, like it's in a highly contradictory state, you know, like it's in a highly ferocious state.
Ultimately, as Canadians, we need to kind of like disentangle ourselves from America.
Yes.
Can you talk about that politically? But I also feel that as an artist, we need to disentangle ourselves culturally from America, because so much of, I think, what people experience culturally in Canada is really just American. Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, our culture industries have been in decline for 50 years, and they remain in decline. I mean, like, you know, I guess that's probably just me speaking, but like, you know, American culture is, and the possibilities for making things in the United States is infinitely higher than it is in Canada, right? Like, yes, I would love to say let's disentangle ourselves from America. In fact, I have an article coming out in the Globe and Mail that says exactly that this weekend. But, you know, the truth of the matter is that, like, it's very, very hard to know how. Like, it's very easy for me to say as a journalist, like, hey, we need to disentangle ourselves from America. They're an enormous market. They're the world's largest market. And we have, you know, like I think it's 80% of our foreign trade is with them. I think it's something like 2.6 million jobs. I don't have those numbers right, but like when NAFTA was rescinded and we had to go and renegotiate, like we just learned how vulnerable we are. Now, we have tried to make some steps, like we've got this bigger arrangement with Europe, this bigger trade deal with Europe. We're a part of the TPP. We're trying to expand our options into China. But, you know, Europe's very far away, and, you know, China is not the country that we want to share our values with. Like, we do not, like, they are an authoritarian state, and we don't want to really be part of them. So, you know, it's very, very hard to know what to do. And as for artists, like, I just don't see how, like, I would love it if we stood our ground and recreated our own culture industry from scratch and like built something really magnificent here. But like the truth is, like we're hidebound and extremely conservative. And if you want to build new things culturally, it is vastly easier to do it in New York and Los Angeles than it is in Toronto or Vancouver. I mean, that to me is just one of the facts of life. I wish it weren't so.
All right. Well, this brings us to, I wanted you to ask you about what you think is going to happen next in the United States, but maybe we can get to that at the end, because this brings me to the reason that we asked you on here today was because both Ali and I were really inspired and really affected by a piece you wrote in the Literary Review of Canada, which is called
In 2017.
Called Canlitt's Colonial Habit. It was sent to me by my friend, and it has a lot in it that I think is important to talk about. But I wanted to start with the notion, because you just mentioned about how hidebound and conservative the Canadian cultural milieu was, the notion that virtue and virtuousness, the role that those things play in Canadian art and in Canadian culture. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, I kind of wonder what you think of that, actually. But because like I've had my own experiences, and it certainly has been formulated by that. But I mean, so I would say, like, you know, the thing is, particularly in books, right? Particularly in the literary industry, where it is just a goody two shoes profession. Like, it is just, it is just like people trying to figure out how to, like, how virtuous can we be? And if you give them a virtue rate plan, like, here's a way to get virtue, they will apply it. And of course, like, when you listen to the CBC, it's just a bunch of virtue systems applied on to these shows until they essentially can't talk about anything
at all.
Well,
yeah, I mean, the Canada Reads, for example, my problem with that has always been this thing of, like, well, argue for which book is best for Canada to read. So you start off with this notion that you're going to take this sort of pill that will make you a better person, and that pill comes in the form of some novel that you desperately don't want to read, but someone will argue with such force that you must, that you eventually will buy it. I mean, that sort of seems to be the premise of that show. I mean,
it's like a marketing thing. It's like dieting. It's like, here's guilt, but here's a book that'll take away that guilt.
Ali and I were talking earlier about how to get art back on its feet. I think, Stephen, that a lot of this has to do, this creeping virtuousness and the value of virtue as you go through the Canadian cultural process, whether you're applying for grants or making art and hoping to have it published or whatever, is that we live in a society that funds art as charity, as something that is good for society, but not necessarily profitable.
And it's reparation, right?
And
instead of, like, you know, like, events in Nova Scotia show that colonialism is ongoing. Like, that's what colonialism looks like. The fishing dispute there, that's what it looked like in the 19th century. We're not addressing that. Instead, we'll do a documentary, right? Like, that's how, and, you know, I think the thing that's really complicated about Canada is that the worst crimes committed in this country, political crimes, were committed by the virtuous. By the best people. Like, you know, the people who set up the schools, the residential schools, now, do not get me wrong, that is an act of genocide, those schools. They did that with their reasons for doing, though, were God and we're going to save these people, right? Rather than, like, the brutality of just going and massacring people, we committed cultural genocide. And I think we have done absolutely no work whatsoever in trying to understand that contradiction, right? That very intense contradiction, which I think still haunts us, you know. It's very hard to it's just that goody two shoes impulse is actually the worst impulse in this country.
So let's take it deeper, because the piece is largely, or begins to be, about the notion of what cultural appropriation within Canada's literary world means.
Yeah.
Can we start with sort of defining the terms, which you attempt to do in the article to some degree? What is cultural appropriation to you?
I mean, it's so, I think when it was written, like in 2017, I feel like that phrase was being redefined, like, literally sometimes on a weekly basis. Like, sometimes it would be like, well, of course it's absurd to think of Picasso using African tropes as appropriation. And then the next week would be like, oh yeah, that is appropriation. In Canada, the really fascinating thing is that you have this goal, like, and I'm speaking just from writers here, just because that's the world I know best. Mm-hmm. But, like, you have this golden age of writers: Atwood, Munroe. Munroe does not mention a single Indigenous character in her entire body of work, right? Mm. Neither does Michael Ondaatje. Margaret Atwood is on the side of the settlers. She goes with, you know, Susanna Moody in the woods, and then there's a very, I mean, it's fascinating in a way. This distinct, totally distinct Canadian genre of white people pretending to be Indigenous and then becoming leading advocates for it. And of course, that's the new scandal. It won't be the last time we see it. But, you know, I really genuinely believe this is distinctly Canadian. I put that on Twitter and someone was like, well, there's a website in the States of, you know, what the activists call pretendians, like people who claim to have like 164th.
Like Elizabeth Warren or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like the 164th Cherokee and stuff like that. But I don't think it's the same way where you have like I'm going to make the number one documentary about indigenous culture. Like it is this, it, you know, for it's obvious, but it probably bears with saying this has nothing to do with any indigenous writer, any indigenous creator who's out there trying to work and trying to make good work. This is just simply a horrible thing that's happened to them.
Well, but you know, so why does it happen? Why do we venerate and then completely cancel these people, whether it's Joseph Borden or Michelle Latimer? It's happened more than three or four times in our country. Yeah. Where's that coming from?
Well, okay, I'm not 100% sure I know, but I will point some. I don't want to put you guys on the spot, but can either of you say hello in any indigenous language?
No, I can say
not in a confident way. No,
I can't. I can't either. So I know Latin. I know how to read Old English. I have a PhD, and they made me take Old English, right? Like
Stephen.
Well, those University of Toronto professors. Honestly, I think we have such a profound ignorance. Like
yes,
the ignorance that we insist on in our dealings with indigenous culture is nearly total, right? Mm. Like it's actually shocking. And I think the whole basis of this country, it's the basis of everything good too, like multiculturalism as well, is predicated on this belief that we're in an empty place. We're in a place that's just landscape, and that we are encountering this landscape. And so the only way that we can the pathology. And I think it is the correct word. The settler pathology in relationship to indigenous culture is so profound. Like it so needs to abnegate and to pretend that indigenous people don't exist, that in some ways what these figures are, like your gray owls and your black wolves and your Joseph Boydens, is they're like that absence kind of formulating into, like, turning into a black hole, like inverting itself. It's like, I'm so, the only way that we can't have a real conversation, like you can't go and say, like, I'm going to go and learn about Cree culture as a white person just out of curiosity. That's not possible to do here. So instead, like, the only way to do it is I'm going to become this, you know, like Ojibwe. I'm going to become an indigenous person. And it is unbelievably common. I mean, you could actually teach a course of the entire history of this country of nothing but cases of it. And if you think about it from 30,000 feet in the air, you essentially have a discourse about indigenous culture that is white people reading and listening to the works of white people pretending to be indigenous. That's like, think about that, like, simply from a psychiatric point of view. It is really, really bizarre. And I think it's true, like, for a culture that doesn't produce a lot that's really distinct, it is like no one else. I don't know of any other culture that has that, that kind of bizarre game.
You write that it's surprising that there isn't more cultural appropriation in Canada, if you think about it, correct?
I mean, especially when you're dealing with such profoundly beautiful cultures, right? Like when you're dealing with West Coast design, I mean, you do see that a bit with West Coast Salish design, where like it gets appropriated in British Columbia, but you do see a little bit of in Quebec too. Ontario, you know, WASP Ontario is the extreme example where there's just absolutely no trace of it whatsoever in buildings, in anything. Right. I mean, like even names, like only occasionally, even places like Wisconsin do this more than we do.
You know, the Trump administration, one of the last things they did was they signed an executive order kind of in the midst of the chaos. Nobody really noticed. They signed an executive order that decreed that all federal buildings shall from here on out only be built in the neo-colonial or Georgian or Roman style.
Right.
So it's like, you know, just in case anyone was thinking, of being influenced by, you know, the Asian culture in America or by the South Asian culture, just in case America was going to change the way it did architecture because it was actually changing, we're going to make sure that doesn't happen. And it does feel to some degree, you know, that whether it was the residential schools or it was the architecture of our government buildings or our great cities, whatever it was an attempt to erase people. And there was this notion that in erasing them, we could face, as you say, an empty country and the weather. You know, I don't know who said it, but somebody said that the, most of Canadian literature is just about bad weather. And I think that that's true because we erased the initial story because we couldn't tell that story because that didn't put us in a very good light. And so now we find ourselves trying to put those people back into the landscape in this way that is forced and false, and but that we have to absorb them into this country that now exists. Is that sort of what you're saying?
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, I think when you look at Canadian art and you see that, like, what we are great at in art terms, and this is true in like 1920, but it's also true in 2020, is landscape. Right. I mean, like landscape paint, like Peter Doig is probably the greatest landscape painter alive. He's Canadian. Right. Like, but landscape is land without people on it. You know, like I think the pathology, the imperial pathology that we inherited, which was the need to make everybody English and to prove, you know, Australia got the criminals. Canada really got the good, poor sons of empire. And we were determined, like, I think when you read a lot of the early prime ministers, there's just this need to be more British than the British, like to be really, really the virtues of Englishness are taken at face value and applied everywhere. You know, so I think one of the things I'm trying to express here is that, you know, as with any racist pathology, like what you do to other people eventually comes back to destroy you, right? Mm-hmm. And in this case, the destruction of indigeneity, the destruction of these cultures, to erase them, to impose like Britishness on the wilderness, really was a crush the belief in originality, you know. And that is the horror that has come back to haunt us and which has always haunted our culture is this fear of originality and this fear of newness. And I don't think you have to look at any aspect of Canadian culture to not see that.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the piece about, you say that if you are painting, if you are making art, if you are doing anything really in Canada as a white person, as a settler person right now, and you haven't read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report, mm-hmm. you shouldn't be making it.
I do believe that.
That really struck me. And I have to say that it. I had read up until I read your article, I had read, I would say, in that report, I had read big sections of it, but I hadn't sat down and taken it as a book. And I've now begun that. So thank you for bringing me up on that, because I 100% agree with that. But can you talk about why you think it's important?
Well, I mean, you know, it's really important. Like, I think we borrow so much from America that we think our history is like America's, but lighter, and it isn't, you know, like we, our past, which is, you know, I think that the Truth and Reconciliation Report is simply the best work of history written about Canada in some very profound way, because it explains, like, when you're like, okay, what didn't happen is we didn't come in and massacre all these people. Instead, they took these people, they put them on incredibly difficult land and told them to farm, and they starved to death. Now that is, when you see that, when you read that story and you see that, you're like, well, that resonated so profoundly to me. That is how we treat anything different. Right. And sort of the I think the garrison mentality, you know, I know it's old fashioned, and like the Canadian lit profs always make fun of me for bringing up these Northrop Frye like ideas. But I really think they capture something that we're still dealing with. And, you know, like, I think until we come to some kind of reckoning with indigeneity, we're not going to be whole as a country. I believe that the pursuit of an original culture for Canada, the pursuit of a culture that only we can make, is part and parcel with dealing with those historical phenomena and dealing with the desire to crush Indigenous culture.
And that means too, right, that you can't just make art about being virtuous and about, you can't make art as a demonstration of your virtuousness. You have to make art that claims the guilt, claims the history, and accepts that is who we are.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, when you put, like, when you say it that way, like, the work that is about guilt is always going to be virtuous. Like, that is, the screamy environment in which we have all these debates doesn't contribute to the extreme nuances that are required to deal with this, the actual realities of this. Like, I think New Zealand might be a really good model for us.
But for everything, it seems.
For a lot of things, but, you know, particularly for dealing with Indigenous matters, where they made a really conscious effort to learn something about Indigenous people, right? I think it seems to me we're really, really early days here. I mean, I don't think we know anything about what we're talking about, really, when it comes to Indigenous culture. When you talk to activists, when you talk to people who are fighting for, like, what they want are their treaty rights and their land rights. Culture is, you know, very low, in my experience anyway. I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but it's very low on what they're interested in dealing with. They don't want power plants destroying their territory, right? Like, and so, and but that barely filters in at all either. And, you know, and I think that the environment where we have these conversations under extreme high pressure, every word parsed, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. But on the other hand, the other way, like, pretending it doesn't exist either is totally ridiculous, right?
Well, one of the ways that we're trying to, like, fix it or atone for it is those land acknowledgements, right? That we do wherever you go somewhere in Canada. Yeah. We say, you know, we are, just to remind you, we're sitting on the original Indigenous land. But you talk about how, you know, while the intent is very noble and it comes from a good place, they're lacking. And they could be made more honest and worthy of, like, the original stain of our nation. Like, why? How?
Well, look what happened in Nova Scotia. I mean, what happened in Nova Scotia is that people wanted the treaty obligations that they were promised by the Crown, and the RCMP could not impose those treaty obligations on the settlers. You know, so, like, when we're doing land acknowledgements, like, if we're not doing land acknowledgements to get to the point where we're not doing that anymore, what is the point? Now, I believe in land acknowledgements. I think they're important.
You just think they should be better. You make a reference that it should be like the Pledge of Allegiance and its beauty and how it's...
They're so terribly written. They're written in exactly this Canadian virtue style by committee, like by 50 people trying to get together and work out, you know, what is the only way we can say this without hurting anyone's feelings at all? I don't find them, like, what are they there for? If they're there to remove to make you feel like a better person, I don't think that's a good use of anyone's time. I think it is essential for us to understand that we have settled land that belonged to other people. Like, we cannot become a meaningful country until we reckon with that reality. But I think this is a first step. But, you know, I was talking to Drew, what's his name? The guy who wrote Up from the Ashes. Drew Hayden?
Oh, yes. Yes.
And he said, it took 7 generations to get us into this mess. It's going to take us 7 generations to get out. That sounds about right to me.
Right. My feeling about land acknowledgements was that initially they were a radical idea whose time had come and seemed like a logical part of reconciliation. And they quickly became, much like everything else, when you go out to the theater, very right. often boring. And there's just no there's no excuse for it to be boring. It's an exciting act. It's a radical act. It's important information, and it is the opening point or the portal to thousands of years of stories and history and culture and life and food and language and all that
yeah.
indigenous communities have to offer.
Yeah, it's just not enough.
Community.
It's not enough.
And so
yeah.
to me, you know, especially in the theater, I find it irksome because from the moment you sit in your chair, I believe the people who are then sold you the ticket have an obligation to fucking entertain you. And you have this incredible moment where you could get up and do something creative about what it means yeah. to be on this land. You could have, you know, have a white person volunteer to get up and get punched. I don't know. Like, there's all kinds of things.
That be one who do it.
That was something. That's something I tried to get happening at the Shaw Festival. Was like tonight's volunteer is, you know, Darlene Dickinson from Mississauga.
No, but I wonder if there's not some way to do some theatrical reading of it, like with. In a meaningful way,
well,
to
yeah,
make it more meaningful. I wonder
have
a, if that's
have an indigenous
why that's not
artist
possible.
There. Have an indigenous artist there making art, and let them take care of what it means for us to acknowledge that land
but
in
see,
that moment.
I don't
it just
think,
feels.
Here's the thing: like, I don't think this is their problem. I don't think
no,
it's the problem. It's,
but
I don't
they,
think it's
a
like,
job
it's
for
not,
an artist is a job for an artist, right? I mean, that's yeah, always, I'm always thinking from that sort of
money,
position
money.
Of like, how do I get money into people's pockets? And
but that's
I just,
exactly how we got the Inconvenient Indian problem, right?
I mean, touche.
Like,
yeah.
No, I mean, look, this is not point scoring. Like,
but you're right. You're right. It's actually you're dead on.
This is not like this is a very complicated issue, and both sides have a you know. Are well, I actually am more on one side than the other, but like the problem here is like when you try and solve these problems through art, there's always these incredible risks. Like, for example, now I personally think that if you did a land acknowledgement where you got, you know, the best actors at Shaw to try and interpret it in some dramatic way, that would be incredible. Like it would resonate a hell of a lot more than, you know, some bureaucrat just standing up and reading it.
Yep.
But on the other hand, the moment you did that, you'd be turning it into theater, which would then be, would it be less serious? Would it be less like it would make
it be criticized on the artistic merits as opposed to the content, you
or
know?
Just that you're not taking it seriously, or that you're turning it into all about you, or like. You know, like there's just a million different ways you could criticize it, always up and down, which is exactly why we do such boring work on this stuff. And it's exactly why, like, the thing you have to remember about like Canada Reads, to get back to that, like the reason they do virtue is because they do not want to do taste. Taste is
right.
too hard.
Right.
Taste require you're probably wrong about your taste. Tastes go in and out of fashion. Taste is just, who does it really belong to? You know, they don't, no one really knows. And that's why it's so much easier to just say, you know what, we'll just make it like what Canada needs to learn.
Okay. So the House is voting on
Are
the
they?
Impeachment. We, I think they're debating. They're going to have a vote later tonight. And
well,
it looks like obviously
heavy stuff today. Eh?
Yeah, man, we don't want to go around.
And we expect obviously that the Democrats are going to go. They're going to vote to impeach in the House. So far, seven Republicans have said they would, including Liz Cheney. Mitch McConnell said that, you know, he's for impeachment. Who knows if he's going to vote to convict? I don't know. Trump is done, but what is going to happen after?
Well, this may seem like an insane argument, but I'll just tell you what I feel from having worked on this for 2 years. And like, Trump was just a massive distraction. If Hillary Clinton had been president, everything that we are seeing now would perhaps would not be as explosive, but would still be happening. You have to remember, like, 43% of Republicans support the storming of the Capitol.
Okay.
So just let that, like, I think when you go to these places, like, ordinary people really, really believe in violence as a political solution. And like, I think when you get to that point, what you have is the, well, prelude to civil war. You know, what happened on January 6th, like, people really need to, it's been called an insurrection. It was not an insurrection. Like, I don't mean to be pedantic, because I have been in this world for a long time. I've been talking to all these scholars, like, but, you know, they were very loosely organized. I mean, just using social media to organize. They had very little political support. They had no military support, and they didn't really have what would classically be called an insurrection. Now, all of that could very easily change. They could very easily get organized. They're highly armed. You know, I went to the world's biggest gun show. You know, it's very easy to buy a 50 caliber rifle.
Nuts.
You know, these people have every weapon up to and including tanks. They have, you know, that several different Nazi groups have been caught by accident with low-grade nuclear weapons. So, you know, they're like, the U.S. military is the U.S. military. No one, they're invulnerable. Like, they are hugely more capable than these insurgents, but the insurgents can cause a huge amount of damage. And I think that's coming. I mean, that's what I think is coming. So that's, I know, a very, very scary and, but like, the thing you have to recognize is that this political chaos in Washington is really a reflection of something that is in the country. Like, they are not, it's not like, oh, they got tricked and they're being manipulated by unscrupulous politicians. It's like, no, actually a sizable portion of the United States, my guess would be about a third, are very, but, you know, like, between a quarter and half, certainly, are all in favor of storming the Capitol building and shitting on the walls.
So it's quite a time.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I don't think, I think people are worried sometimes about the wrong things. Trump would definitely be not, I don't think Trump is worth worrying about. I never did. Like, the worry is that, the thing to really worry about is the white power people in the U.S. military and the, you know, the white power infiltration of law enforcement in the United States. I mean,
I think we're going to find out some shit.
I talked to an FBI agent. I talked to an FBI agent 3 weeks ago, who said that they cannot. The real way to stop terrorism is first of all disrupting the financial networks, but the second thing is watch lists. That's by far the most effective way to stop terrorism, and they cannot send watch lists out for domestic terrorism in the United States because the police departments they're sending them to are all rife with white power and Klansmen, and they'll just tell the Klansmen that they're under investigation.
Holy.
Right. So that's an FBI agent, right? Like, that's like, you see what I mean? Like, people are worried about, like, a guy with Viking helmets on. I'm like, don't worry about that guy. That guy's going to jail. Like, the people that were like, to me, Biden should have one job. Like, the Democratic Party in Washington should have one job, which is destroying and disrupting domestic terrorism in the United States. It will be all they can do. If they can do it, it will be all they can do. And like, that needs to be the only priority.
So much to talk about with you, man. It's unbelievable. Yeah. I wanted to talk about Shakespeare for a while, but we have time. But will you come back and talk about Shakespeare?
Because I'd love to. I mean, I keep thinking about what's his name's Richard III that got canceled. Oh, I would have loved to have seen it.
I mean, can you believe, though, like, is there a more relevant playwright to what's happening right now on Earth? It's just
Coriolanus, man. It's I know. All in Coriolanus.
My wife it's just amazing. Finished playing Coriolanus last year, and right. She has been, every time she walks into the room and I'm obsessively watching CNN, she's like, the mob, there it is. It's Coriolanus.
But also the elite that don't care about their own country.
Yes, yes.
But are vapidly patriotic, but don't actually care about the Roman people or whatever. They actually feel closer to the tyrants that they're supposed to be fighting. I mean, it is.
It's like a huge clusterfuck of the everything in Julius Caesar, everything in Macbeth, and everything in Coriolanus, all coalescing. I mean, obviously Donald Trump never read the fourth act of Macbeth. It
doesn't end well. No,
He might have read half of it in the Coles.
Where are you going to find a scene in Shakespeare where a policeman is beaten to death on the steps of the Capitol with an American flag and a flagpole. I mean, like, you can't, like where are you going to find something that on, like, allegorical? I mean, it's just, these scenes are really, really incredible. I mean, and even though I, you know, have been working on this and predicting it and like looking at it very closely, I mean, it still does take your breath away, because they're the thing that I don't think they really understand that's amazing is that they don't really understand the cost of violence. Like, they, like when you enter into this violence, you're going to lose everything. Like, yeah. you lose your economy, you lose your stability, you lose, like, civil wars are the worst things that can happen to a country. They're much worse than being occupied. Like, they are wars of total meaning, and they get incredibly vicious. They're wars between populations. They get savage beyond belief everywhere, you know, in Europe, everywhere, and in the Middle East, everywhere. And, like, I don't think they really have recognized how much pain they're about to go through.
This is why I don't understand the Josh Hawleys of the world. I know, exactly. I know, like, I don't understand. It's, you know, Princeton, Yale, like, even Ted Cruz, you know, yeah. Harvard Law School, like, these people know better. McConnell. It's those people who I don't get. The individual who is, you know, by happenstance, that's the thing about social media. It's like they, you know, walk into a Klan meeting. They don't even know. They're just opening up Facebook.
Yeah.
Right. But that's not what's going down with the Hawleys and the Cruises and the McConnells. So what is up with those people?
They are the truly unforgivable, because, yes, like, you know, because, like, the thing is, and, you know, it does emerge from this exceptionalism. They just think that, you know, what happens to Syrians can't happen to them. And it's like, You know what? It can. It absolutely can. Like, you're not in some world where there are no consequences to these actions, but they operate in this world where they just feel so kind of safe that because they're America, it's all going to work out. I think, like, they're just the like, how can Josh Hawley not know that raising your fist to an angry mob that is about to storm the Capitol is not going to end well, you know, for him or for his country. But, you know, like, also there's just the real basic question of disloyalty here. I mean, you know, a republic cannot survive people like that. It can survive Trump. But it can't survive people who are not even willing to make the small sacrifice. Like, there was a big deal made about, like, Pence refusing to do this nonsense that Trump asked him. And they were like, yeah, big sacrifice. He's never going to be president. And I was like, you know, my grandfather flew over Germany bombing it, like, so that democracy could survive. Like, giving up a chance to be president is not too much to ask to preserve democracy. Like, it's just not.
Many, you know, men with a lean and hungry look in that part of the world.
Exactly.
It's pure raw power that they seek. Yeah. It's venality at its most fucking uncut. Look, you're amazing. We really appreciate you giving us so much to think about. And I really do hope you come back and we can talk some more, because
anytime.
I think we only scratched the surface. That would be great. Thank you, Stephen. Really appreciate
pleasure.
It. We'll see
talk
you soon.
Talk to you guys later. Ciao.
Bye-bye. Stephen Marsh on Soft Revolution. Boom. So many ideas.
We could have kept going for another hour.
It was an ideas explosion. I can't even, like, so great. Yeah, we do have to have Stephen back, because I think we just touched on a number of things. And I didn't want to keep you all here listening to this podcast all day, but I feel like there's a lot more to be unpacked with Stephen Marsh. Go and read his work. You may not agree with everything he says. But boy, is he a lively, deep and clear mind. You know, that's what I got from talking to Stephen, was a lot of
Definitely.
Clarity. And it made me feel like, you know, when you had great professors in university, that to me, great professors were people who suddenly instigated a whole new line of thought in you. Not that their thoughts were the things you held on to, but that their thoughts triggered something in you. And that's what I appreciated about talking to Stephen.
And that's what his piece is, which we are going to put in the show notes. They will be in the show notes, the links to his piece about the American Civil War impending 2018, and then the piece in the New Yorker about the land acknowledgments, and then finally that in the Canlit book review.
And he's written this book that I now want to read very much, and that we will get round to, because it's called How Shakespeare Changed Everything. And we just started to talk about Shakespeare at the very end, but I think I've been thinking so much about how once again, this weird guy from Stratford-on-Avon, every once in a while in human history, for some reason, these plays just, there they are, speaking of the exact moment that we live in. You know, whether it's the plague or it's political uprisings, he is there. Shakespeare is there and feels so vital and so present. So we'd love to have Stephen back to talk about that. Okay, that's the pod for another week, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. Next week, it might just be Allie and I yelling at each other, or we might have someone amazing. We really don't know yet, but we will endeavor to make it great in any case. I know it's hard out there. Some of you are running out of EI. Some of you probably have already run out of EI. It feels like
some of you can't even get EI because of some stupid loophole. Yeah.
And it feels like these fucking vaccines are moving too slow. And I don't know about y'all, but I have been feeling particularly down for the last few days about the prospects for artists. But I also feel that this moment of disruption and turmoil and pain and violence and misunderstanding, there is only one goddamn thing that human beings have ever come up with to face these problems, and it's art. And that's why we got to just keep doing it for as many people as we can in whatever shitty way we can right now.
Damn right.
We just got to keep doing it, right, buddy?
Yeah, baby.
Got to keep doing it. What's your art pick this week?
Yo-Yo Ma. I always think that's like a Seinfeld reference.
If y'all get it.
But actually, no. Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma.
When,
it's classic.
When Kramer gets a head injury. Yeah. And he only shaves half his face. Oh, God. I want to do about Seinfeld, but I know there's already 50 of them.
I'd love to do a podcast. We were talking about maybe Valentine's Day we'd do a little podcast about love in the arts, and maybe we will, but we got to do a Seinfeld podcast. Why not?
We got to do it. Yeah, it's coming up good soon, for the, folks.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But definitely, you know, Yo-Yo Ma playing Bach, brother. I've just been like playing those cello suites.
Yes.
You know, whenever I'm feeling just whatever you're feeling, I just put it on. It's like it's magic. It truly is magic.
I've written for hundreds of hours to that music. I think that to me is the real function of that stuff is deep focus, deep meditation, deep.
What else have you done to that music, Torkel? Okay, I'm joking.
I'm not Sting. I just, you know. But yeah, I love those things too. My art pick is this wonderful thing on Netflix called Pretend
Queen's Gambit.
Pretend It's a City, it's called. And what it is made by Martin Scorsese, and it is a 4-part documentary about the writer Fran Lebowitz.
I've heard about that. Wow.
And cool. You know, I haven't lived in New York now in almost 20 years. I spent 10 years of my life there. It's a place I love really deeply. I know it's going through huge riches and terrible pain right now, and it's lost so much of what makes it New York. And Fran Lebowitz, it was really a balm for me to watch Fran Lebowitz talk about New York City and about her attitude towards life, which is so much informed by living in New York, in which I still have so much of it is in me, even though I now live in the opposite of New York, Vancouver. But she's hilarious and she's kind and she has some really beautiful little aphorisms about art and about what it means to be an audience, what it means to be an artist, and what it means to be a New Yorker. And essentially what I love about it is that the real argument is to be an artist is to be a New Yorker. And I kind of believe that. So go check that out on Netflix. It's called Pretend It's a City, and it's really fun. I think you'll like it. That's it for another week of Soft Revolution. Stay strong, everybody. We are going to make it through this bullshit. See you next week. Love you, Ali.
Love you, man. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.